Today, part two of my visit with Glenn Duncan, who is, by all accounts, a legend. He won't say that, but I will. If you listened last week, you heard the first part of our conversation. We're going to pick it up right where we left off, continue with Glenn's career up till today with some new music and discussions of all of the history that he's lived and been a part of with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and the producing that he's doing. You're going to enjoy it. Glenn is a great guest. If you just tuned in, I'm talking to Glenn Duncan. Glenn, you've taken us pretty far so far, but only by comparison to other people. We could do this for a long, long time, and I want you to
fill in. Oh, let's do it.
We'll do it forever. We'll fill in some gaps on Bill Monroe. I know you did some work with the Osborne Brothers.
Yes.
But I had referenced this to the incredible thing that Earl did. We were talking about Earl and the impact he had. A Grammy. Two times for the same tune recorded, I don't know, 40 years apart? You were part of that recording of Earl Scruggs and Friends where they did Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yeah. It was amazing for me. And I think the most rewarding thing about the whole Foggy Mountain Breakdown, winning a Grammy for Foggy Mountain Breakdown with Earl Scruggs was how big the impact of hearing the Mercury recording of Flatt & Scruggs doing Foggy Mountain Breakdown. You and I have talked about this. I promise you, they could have cut that song 1,000 times, and there would have been 999 other versions of it that aren't as good, and then there would be the one that it's just the holy grail.
It is.
I think a big piece of the thing was, number one, Sonny Osborne and I used to be when I was traveling with the Osborne Brothers, we talked about Flatt & Scruggs probably 65% of the time and Bill Monroe 35% of the time, and that's pretty much what we talked about. We loved Emmons. We would talk about Buddy some, and we would talk about other songs. But we talked about Flatt & Scruggs so much because they had loved those records. In fact, that's one thing about the Osborne. Very unique, totally unique, as a matter of fact. They are the first bluegrass act that came along after the Bill Monroe, Lester, Chubby, Earl, and Howard band that studied another bluegrass band closely. Now, naturally, the Stanley Brothers had heard Molly and Jim Brooks, so, Ralph was going to play like Earl, and Pee-wee was going to sing like Bill, and that, and Don Reno and Red Smiley, after Flatt & Scruggs, after Earl started playing the banjo like he did, anybody playing a five-string banjo was going to play like Earl, even if he was, as an innovator like Don Reno, still, you would play the Doing My Time role, which, Reno played on a lot of stuff, and that's how you do that. It ain't no different than, it's in the key of G, and you play an open G chord on a guitar, you don't play a closed chord. I mean, it's that elemental that he became such a part of that fabric, but there's a thing about, so the Osborne Brothers had studied those records too. I mean, they knew Bobby Osborne right now, right today. We can go. He lives 20 minutes from me. I can run right up to his house, and we can sit right there, and he can still play for you note for note on the fiddle, every fiddle break from every Flatt & Scruggs on Mercury recording ever made. All of them, all 28 of them, he knows. If they had a fiddle on it, because some of them are just, gospel on a guitar, but all the rest of them, he knows them all. He knows all the fiddle breaks. Sonny knows every banjo lick. They had really, 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 I call it, done their homework about, this is how you, and I still really stress that to people today who are learning to play bluegrass is, man, study the masters and memorize it all. You will learn things that you don't even anticipate while you are learning what they did or memorizing what they did. It will lead you down other paths. But the one thing about it is you will know that everything you're learning was done right. Well, Foggy Mountain Breakdown, the big thing about Foggy Mountain Breakdown was it's the sound of that record. I mean, we've talked about that. But if that if the same five guys had gotten today at Sound Emporium in Nashville and recorded this and played it exactly the same way, it would not sound like it did back then. There's a magic thing that happened with the way that song was recorded with the technology that they had at the time that cannot be duplicated. You can never, ever make that sound ever again. And here's another big, big thing that we all know now because bands started doing it again. Cordell and I started doing this, and when we started doing it, nobody was doing it, but I love the way the Del McCurry Band works now. They've really got that thing, too. What you're doing is you're blending yourself before it hits the microphones. You're standing together around a common, you know, in microphones, but common. So you are blending yourself. You're making your own sound.
You're the sound mixer. You're part of the mixing.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And mm-hmm. as I put it, you know, a lot of times to people, like if they're talking about, hey, we're going to try to record this the way they did the old stuff. And, I mean, that's an admirable pursuit. I glory in their spunk. However, you can't. It can't be done because the technology is so different for how microphones work. And, you know, if it was recorded at a radio, you know, station, old tube gear, even if you had all the same old gear and everything else, you just can't. It's a magic record. You know, there's a few magic records in bluegrass. There's Uncle Penn, the 1950 cut, Bill Monroe, Red Taylor, Jimmy Martin, Rudy Lyle, you know, that record. Stanley Brothers, Little Maggie, you know, with that they cut over at Stardust and Dickerson Road, Ralph Mayo and Curly Lambert playing stock rhythm guitar, and Carter and Ralph. I mean, you just can't make that sound again. And Foggy Mountain Breakdown was that powerful. And boy, I mean, to people who aren't even like banjo players, banjo fans, or anything, and the probably the best illustration I know of that is that Warren Beatty called Earl's office, which was in their house in Madison when he still lived in Madison, and Louise was, you know, that's who you would call when you called Earl's office. You talked to Louise, and Warren Beatty called up. I mean, just out of the clear blue sky, Warren Beatty calls Louise Scruggs. One of the funny things about it is, he had no idea that Louise read Variety magazine. Louise knew every single thing that was happening in show business, including through the whole time that we were all hanging out together. She would call my wife almost every day, literally almost every day, and tell her something that she had just seen in one of the trade publications, because Louise Scruggs and Earl Scruggs, they were 100% totally committed to music as a business and music as a career. Mm-hmm. And so, but the funny part is Warren Beatty doesn't know that. He's calling Earl Scruggs. He's thinking, well, you know, that's these guys at the Grand Ole Opry in the string ties and the hats, you know. So he calls Louise, you know, Louise answers the phone, and Warren Beatty says, hey, you know, this is Warren Beatty. I'm an actor. And, of course, Louise immediately says, oh, I know who you are, Warren. Yes, Earl and I are big fans, you know. Well, that's nice. Well, I'm doing a movie about Bonnie and Clyde, and I heard a banjo tune that, you know, Flat and Scruggs recorded, and it's really breakneck speed, and it'd just be perfect for all these chase scenes in this Bonnie and Clyde movie. It's going to be perfect. It's just perfect. And he said, now, I don't know what the name of it is, but all I do know is, he said, it's got some kind of a minor chord in it or something. And Louise says, oh, that'd be Foggy Mountain Breakdown. And so he said, okay, that'd be great. And, of course, Foggy Mountain Breakdown, the cut that we all talk about, is the one on Mercury Records, first time they ever recorded. Of course, they're on Columbia by the time Warren calls them. So Louise, you know, he says, could you send me a copy? She said, I will send you Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Well, she sends Foggy Mountain Breakdown, of course, on Columbia, because that's the label they're on right now. You know, for business reasons, that would be a better thing for them. So she sends that to Warren Beatty. You know, overnights it to him, however how they did it back then. And, boy, just immediately, quick, you know, he gets it, and he calls Louise again and says, hey, I got the recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown. I said, yes, I'll send it to you, you know, fast, express, whatever.
Listen, man, when I've heard other people do Earl, but I've never heard anyone do Louise Scruggs.
Oh, yeah. So I'll send it to you, you know, express post, you know. And he said, yeah, and he said, is there another version of that? He said, this is not the one I was thinking about. He said, I mean, I think it's the same song, but the one I was thinking about, it just has a, is there another version of it? And Louise said, yeah, I'll send that one out to you. So she sent the Mercury one to him. The point of that story is there was a magic on that Mercury record. I mean, everything about it, you know, the fiddle break, about that second fiddle break, you know, just that, it almost sounds like they're overloading a mic. I mean, it's like literally pegging. It's what it sounds like, you know, like the level, you know, now they would, you know, it would be, and it had to be compressed back then to a degree, but man, it was kicking stuff way over into the red. I mean, there's just a magic about the way that record sounded the day they recorded it. It's changed so many lives. I mean, almost everybody I know who plays a banjo, it's Foggy Mountain Breakdown. You know, say, well, what made you, including me, you know, what made you want to play the banjo? I had a Foggy Mountain Breakdown. I heard Foggy Mountain Breakdown, and I said, I got to have a banjo. In fact, when I first got a banjo, as I'm teaching myself how to play it, I learned the backward roll first because of the E minor. Da, 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 da. I thought, well, that's how he's doing the whole song. He's doing it with a backward roll.
Well, did you learn that also from playing guitar?
Yeah, guitar and steel,
mm-hmm.
And then too, I heard Earl as I'm playing along. I heard him playing Home Sweet Home, you know, with the backward roll.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, gosh, it's the backward roll. So I've never had trouble playing a backward roll. And the reason I bring that up, Sonny and I have talked about this a lot, because he thinks Earl learned the backward roll first. He's convinced of it. He thinks that, and I think that too. And I think that because of Home Sweet Home. Sonny thinks it because of the backward roll that he would use on the C7th on Stuck in the Corner stuff, and he could actually gain speed on it, whereas most people are like, uh-oh, you know, how am I going to get out of this? But I think he did because of Home Sweet Home because Home Sweet Home is a real, I think when you hear Earl Scruggs play Home Sweet Home on a banjo, I think you're hearing the earliest thing that exists of Earl on a banjo. Now, he came up with his role playing Reuben. Reuben is what he was playing sitting on the front porch when he came up with, what you and I would think of as the semi-backward roll. Some people call it the forward-backward roll. Some people call it the eight roll. I usually call it the roll in my sweet baby's arms roll.
Yeah, I like that.
It's that one, you know. And so when he first came up with that, he was sitting and playing Reuben, alternating thumb, you know, alternating thumb, index thumb, and, you know, that. And then towards the end of it, he accidentally hit on what we now know is, you know, that's what made the whole Scruggs thing become the whole Scruggs thing. And he told me, told me the story, and it's a pretty powerful scene. If I was making a movie of Earl's life, this would be a big scene. Is Earl sitting on the front porch of his house as a little kid, and his brother, Junie, owned a banjo and was trying to be a banjo player, too. But Earl's like, you know, a prodigy. He's just a really gifted young kid learning to play the banjo. And so Earl's sitting on the front porch playing. And he said, Junie, and he had just come up with what we now know as kind of the way he played Reuben, the first part of Reuben, even the whole time I was with him, or the whole his whole life. He never changed it. He played it like that then. But you got to picture his older brother walking down the road, and I do mean road, is a road, and he's hearing Earl sitting on the front porch of his house playing Reuben, like we now hear him play the front part, and nobody's ever heard that before. And he said, well, I'm just sitting there playing it. Junie come walking by, and he said, I hit that, well, you know, and Earl's sitting there on the banjo at the time. And it's what we're talking about, you know, the forward, backward roll, semi-backward roll, whatever. And he said, I put that in there. And he said, as soon as I hit that lick, said, Junie, boy, he stopped in his tracks. And he looked over at me and said, look on his face, and he said, you're on to something now. You're on to something now. And then, you know, naturally he built his whole style on just that. You know, that whole how to make four, you know, three go into four.
You said that, yeah, that's the best description I've heard.
Yeah.
Let me tell you one story, and then I want to talk to you more about the Grammy-winning recording.
Yeah.
When I, first time I had Earl, not the first time, second time I had Jerry Douglas on the show, I in advance of a week of that, I lined up everything that the Earl, this was for the live one, everything they did, and I lined up everything that Flatt and Scruggs, and I listened to them back to back to back to back to back, which is kind of what you do. And and the Earls, you know, the Earls of Leicester, they're top guys. They're top guys, and they got all the recording equipment, and they're doing it, and they're basing on that. But you know what? It did not compare to those original recordings. And there was some spark. It's the same thing you're talking about.
Yes.
There's something different about that sound. And I actually thought it would be the different way. I lined them up side by side, and I thought, wait a minute. Same equipment, played them on the same equipment, and it wasn't even close.
Not even close. And I've heard lots of people over the years, you know, somebody say, you know, I actually got a live recording of Flatt and Scruggs playing Foggy Mountain Breakdown, and it's better than that original recording. And I always say, wow, I'd love to hear it. But in my mind, and I don't want to be that guy, so I'm just saying, wow, that's cool, you know, because, hey, to them it is. But in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, no, you don't either.
No.
you do not have a better, and ask Earl Scruggs himself, no. There never was. I mean, that was just a moment in time. And there's Sonny and I, which is, you know, talking about when I was playing with the Osbournes, we used to talk about Lester and Earl all the time. One thing that is really big about early Lester and Earl, everything up to maybe 55, man, they are playing. And in fact, you know, people talk about, you know, Flatt and Scruggs not being together anymore, you know, from, you know, 69 on. Well, one thing. They had played 6 days a week from the time they started till almost the time they dissolved the partnership. And Earl, that's why Earl started flying. He wanted to be home some. But they each, in the early days, Lester would take off 1 week, and they would usually get Hilo Brown to substitute for him, and Earl would take off 1 week, and that was it. And everybody else was playing 6 days a week. So at the time of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, they have an early morning show that they're doing at maybe 5:45 at a radio station. Then they have a noon show. Then they're playing schoolhouses around the area that are small, so they're lots of times turning the house at least twice. And Earl said, like Sandy Ridge, North Carolina, he would always talk about it. He said they'd have to do 3 shows. So if you play that much every day, 6 days a week, 51 weeks a year, one thing you can be sure of, what talent you do have, you are maximizing it. So that's the thing. There will never be a band come along and play at the level of tightness and anticipation and dynamic, just everything they had going for them. And then, I mean, then Earl could put the banjo down, pick up a guitar, and do it just as well.
I'm talking to Glenn Duncan, and I just want to interrupt you real quickly because before I forget, you know, we knew about these Martha White films and tapes and forever. Like, where are they going to come out? Well, now they've become available. And you and I were talking before we went on the air about you talk about all that practice and all that expertise and knowing that when you see those Martha White films and Earl steps up to play, he looks dead at the camera and like, I know I got it now.
Yeah,
that look on his face, he's looking right in your soul and he's saying, yep, I'm the guy.
He's like, he knew everybody else was fighting for number two.
That's right.
There wasn't going to be nobody ever touch him.
Here it is. I'll show you everything I'm doing. It's not going to matter.
Yes, that's right. Oh, that was so true. And you know what was funny to me about it was you know, from hearing him play up close every day, day in and day out, when we worked together. And as much, you know, as I've played a banjo on people's records and been, I've, you know, played in a band with Sonny Osborne for 4.5 years and 3 different stretches. That's how much I love playing with the Osborne Brothers. I quit twice and went back. So I played with them 3 different times and loved being around them. We just had a ball the whole time we played together. And then I played in a band, you know, worked with Jim Majestic. Alan Shelton was the banjo player. And, boy, I'm telling you, Alan Shelton. In fact, I always say this. When people talk about me playing with Jim Majestic, I always say, well, I love playing with Jim Majestic, but the best part was I played with Jim and Jesse and Alan. Because when it was all three of them, it was just a whole nother level. Because Shelton was a machine on timing. His timing was just phenomenal. And yeah, I'll just tell you one little quick thing.
Oh, I love Alan. Please do.
Oh, the banjo player, I always thought it was an interesting way to think about it. He thought about his own roles, you know, like the thing he does, it's the steel guitar lick, you know, does it on a bunch of their songs, you know, 1 chord, 4 chord, 1 chord, 4 chord. A lot of them have that in him. Here's how he thought about that role, and he thought about his roles that are really Shelton-esque. He thought about that role as, he would call it leading with my index finger. So that's the way he came up with that role, was the, you know, the first thing is the index finger on the second string. And that's how he thought of that role. And then another of his licks that's real famous, he thought about that as leading with his middle finger on the first string. So he had a whole different way of thinking about it.
Wow.
But, man, his timing was like a machine. And I'll tell you one great thing about playing fiddle with Jim and Jesse when Alan Shelton was your banjo player. He was 6'5". And he wore that banjo up, you know, with the strap over his neck back when almost nobody did. And he played with it up real high. So when we played Sally Gooden together, he was enough taller than me that, man, that banjo was right in my – I was with my head, literally right down. And here's what I was doing. I was – and I did that with a lot of bands. I did that with Longview. We did it too. Where I would get, like, the fiddle, like with Longview, fiddle and Dudley in the same mic, kind of. I would get down to where we were playing, and so what we were doing, we were making a sound together, and then the mic was just capturing that. That's really what you hear on Foggy Mountain Breakdown, the old record. You hear them blending themselves, and then those old mics and all that tube stuff are capturing the sound that they were able to make in that room that day.
Yeah. So they were close enough together. I see what you're saying.
That's it. And I've told a lot of people that too. When they talk about, well, how do you play backup? You know, how did you play backup? You know, with the Osborne Brothers or something. And I say, well, if you think about bluegrass, I said it's an ensemble form of music. And I said, you know, because lots of times it's a somebody whose their son is, you know, a professional fiddle player just starting out. And the dad will say, you know, what do I tell him about backup? And I said, I'll tell you this. I said, if you think about any kind of music, I said, the key to it is help the singer tell the story. And I said, if you think about bluegrass, I said, bluegrass music, it started with 5 people all just standing around together. So it would have been real hard for Chubby Wise to play over the top of Bill Monroe singing a verse because he was close enough Bill could have swatted him and would have.
And would have, yeah.
Yeah, but the key was Bill was up at the mic, so you played to help the guy up at the mic. I always tell it this way. Look at the singer. If the whole time you're playing backup, you'll just look at the singer. You'll know what to do, and you'll help the singer tell that story. And that's why Earl was so good at playing backup with people. And he was, you know, never any better. And Sonny Osborne, too, an absolute genius. Those two guys, you know, for playing backup are just, you know, yeah. I could listen to somebody said, what should a banjo do? And I say, well, pretty much Doing My Time. If you listen to Doing My Time from start to finish, yep. that's about that's about as good as you could do. And then with the Osborne Brothers, you know, for the way they played and the style, you know, as music had changed and sonically had changed, Sonny the same thing for playing backup. I mean, you just couldn't beat it because he was thinking of ways to make Bobby sound good. And
I've heard Sonny say this before many times, actually, and I don't mean just to me, but I've heard him say it in groups before, that the what's up front is count, and what he's talking about is the vocal. That's what makes the difference.
Absolutely. That's what I've done, you know, and that's the reason, you know, that I've recorded with so many people and, you know, still record with, you know, who I want to record with is if you can help make a singer sound better and help a singer tell the story of a song, you are always going to make a really great living as a musician. that's just the absolute truth, because if you can help, you know, Lefty Frizzell sings Saginaw, Michigan, and he knows it, and the producer knows it, and the engineers know it. You know, you're gonna get all the work you can do.
I think that's it. And the other thing he used to say too is, you know, look, as proud of Sonny was of his ability, which he recognized also, but he would also say this: look, eventually somebody would have done everything that I did, but nobody could have been Bobby.
I know. And he, you know what? I think that's the coolest thing about Bobby and Sonny's relationship is, I'm telling you, boy, Sonny Osborne, you're not going to talk to Sonny for 5 minutes before he tells anybody that Bobby Osborne is the greatest to ever walk the planet with a high voice, you know, in country music, you know, this kind of country music and bluegrass. And boy, I mean, that's going to be the first thing and the last thing he says about anything to do with, you know, their success was Bobby. And boy, I'll tell you what else, man. Boy, Bobby was, talk about just a one of a kind voice and range. And his, Bobby understood songs. He understood how to sell a song as he sang it. And Bob, but think about both of them. Again, I go back to, they had studied a lot, and Bobby had studied singers. He had studied, you know, he grew up, when he was first starting out, he wanted to be Ernest Tubb. Sounds funny now, you know. But that he was, so he could sing any Ernest Tubb song in history, you know, that he knows them. That's what he was doing. He was singing like Ernest Tubb and playing an electric guitar, you know, when he started out.
Oh, I never heard that.
Yeah, that's what he was doing. And he could still do every Ernest Tubb song, you know, and he was trying to, you know, play a guitar and sing like Ernest Tubb. And then they heard Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. And Bobby's actually one of the few people I know who's still living, still with us, who actually saw the original five. There's so few people. Actually, wasn't a whole lot of people, because a lot of people saw Bill, Lester, Earl, Chubby, and Birch playing bass. But Bobby actually saw Bill, you know, with Howard Watts, the whole band, the original five thing, and he saw him in Dayton, Ohio. He wanted to go see, heard they were going to be there, and his dad took him to the show. And so he's one of the few. One of the few, and Earl would always say that the only person that he knew, this is a little interesting tidbit, Earl would always say this, the only person he ever knew that was listening to the Grand Ole Opry the first night that he played with Bill Monroe in 1945 was Tut Taylor. He said Tut Taylor had told him early on, I was listening the first night you ever played with Bill Monroe, and that's the only person that he ever knew for sure was listening that he knew later in life, you know.
Glenn, you made an interesting point, it's a sad thing, but it's just a reality thing. You came along when, you mentioned this before, and it might have been off of the air, but, you know, here you are, a young kid, and there's Bill Monroe. Yeah. And the first, we'll call them the first generation. Yeah. They were all available to you. And if you want to blend the Osborne Brothers right in below, Flat and Scruggs and Bill Monroe, the original, and it was part of the attraction to you, that you could, you could get into a music that was all of the, important people were still walking around and were still playing a major role in the music.
Absolutely. It had a lot to do with why I chose to be a bluegrass, you know, for bluegrass music to be like at the core of what I did. Was it was the only kind of music I had any access to where the guys who invented it were still with us. And when I was, you know, starting out, man, they were still bringing it. You know, they were still great. And so, I, in other words, I could go to the source. I could go to Bill Monroe. I could travel with Bill. I was a bluegrass boy. I was traveling with Bill Monroe, and I would ask him anything. I was set about both of them, him and Earl Scruggs. I got to find out everything I ever wanted to know from both of them. Now, with Earl, you know, he and I have been in Louise or just traveling around, so I could ask him, and he would tell me, or if we were sitting and he had the banjo, you know, he would play whatever, you know, or I would ask him all kinds of stuff, you know, like I'd ask him about, so you remember the first time you ever did, you know, the thing on, you know, like Bugle Call Rag or the ending on her, you know, you know, that.
Yeah.
I said, you remember the first time you ever did that? And, oh, boy. And he did. He would remember. And he would remember, yep, I sure do, you know, or, you know, the thing on Earl's Breakdown where he starts walking down the second string.
Mm-hmm.
I would ask him, I would say, you remember the first time you ever did that? And the ending lick, it was when they were in Versailles, Kentucky. And he said, it just hit him to do the, and he said, I knew it wanted to go up high, but so I went up, and he said, when I do something like that, I said, he said, I was doing it much for the boys in the band, you know, because we'd working together so much, I was just trying to entertain them, and he said, I did, he said, I went up high, and then, boy, I just fell apart. I didn't have nothing. Everybody laughed, and I thought, I'm going to have to go home and figure out something to do. So that's what he did. He came up with the first part, and then he knew he wanted a high note, but he had no way he had figured out to get out of it. So then he would have to, you know, get it down and go, well, now what am I going to do to get out of it? But the best part about, and I say this about probably the easiest way is really is to talk about working with Bill, because and all of us who are bluegrass boys, Peter Rowan, Del McCurry, I don't, you know, Del and I don't live too far apart, so I get to see Del all the time. He's one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. Love him, love his whole family, and just love every minute I spend with Del McCurry. And so when we get together, we immediately play bluegrass boy music in that way. I mean, because there's only one way to do it. It's that way. And the way I explain it to people, I think the easiest way to get it across about what you learned from being with the source guys, which was really in bluegrass music, Bill and Earl, because of instrumentally. You know, now when it comes to songwriting and singing and everything else, Lester Flatt, you know, it couldn't have been done without Lester Flatt. If Lester had only written the songs, I mean, his just ability as a songwriter is just staggeringly great.
And, it always seemed like he was just talking.
Oh, that's it. And he was such a, never been a better front man. He was a star. He was just a big star. What are you talking about? I'll just one little quick thing, then I'll get back to this train of thought, but talk about getting to see the first generation guy. I mean, actually, even as a little kid, I actually even got to see Carter Stanley, you know. And I've had people say, what do you remember about seeing Carter Stanley? It's funny because I couldn't have been any older than 11. But the thing that always struck me about Carter was as a little kid was he seemed so big. And now I know what that meant was he was such a charismatic performer on a stage that he just seemed big. Because, I mean, he wasn't really big. Ralph was pretty small, but he wasn't like a great big guy. You know, Shuffler was pretty good size. But when I saw him together, Carter just had so much presence. And Lester Flatt always had that, too. Just so much presence. And then, you know, of course, nobody has any more presents than Bill Monroe. No. You know,
that wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, no, well, boy, that would, you're right. Yep. I think that you know, we ought to have call it Bluegrass Boy Rules. You know, there should have been a rule book, and that would be in the first five rules. You know, whatever you do, don't attempt to have more charisma than Bill, because it ain't going to end. Not going to be pretty. But the thing about Bill, about playing with Bill, that you learned as a bluegrass boy. Well, number one, I had a huge advantage, huge advantage, because I knew Bill Monroe my whole life, and I had grown up, because of Bean Blossom just being, you know, a half hour away, that we had gone to see Bill Monroe a zillion times, and so I am convinced that what you hear as a kid, and even as from the time you're born, it stays in your mind as things that you like. You are drawn to certain sounds, like these sounds we're talking about. I all go back to what we heard as a kid. And I remember one of my best friends here in town, producer and prolific author, working on his 40th book, and just an amazing man named Don Cusick. And we were talking one time about, he's done biographies on, good heavens, Eddie Arnold and Mike Curb and Reba, and he's doing Chet Atkins' biography right now. Just an amazing man, a PhD in history, and his office is Owen Bradley and Billy Sherrill's old office in what is now part of the Curb operation, but at the time was it's the Quonset, you know, Columbia's Studio A and B. That's where his office was.
Wow.
And we were talking, and he's done. They did the Roger Miller biography and all this. And we were talking one time, and he was asking me about, you know, my favorite albums and all that. And I do a lot of work with Don, where like we did a bunch of records. We got a Bobby Bear, Jimmy Brown, the Browns. There's a Jeannie Seeley album we just did that's going to be out later this year. We just did one with the Mercury Sisters. All kinds of stuff. Tribute to Eddie Arnold album that was really great. Bunches of records together. And we were talking one day. It's a really interesting observation that he had. And I was explaining to him, when it comes to rock music, I said, man, you know, I said, it occurred to me one day that, like, of my 10 favorite most influential albums, the band, the Brown album and Stage Fright. And then with the Rolling Stones was Let It Bleed, and then there was a couple Bob Dylan things, you know, that were in his electric era, like a Rolling Stone and that stuff. And I said, it kind of occurred to me one day that, like, you know, five of the biggest albums to me in my, you know, formation as a musician were all recorded within about a 24-month period. And I said, that's always struck me. You know, how that's odd. And then, you know, found out later that several of these bluegrass records are recorded in that same time period, or released in that same time period. And he said, I'll bet it's between the time you were 14 and 17. And I said, yeah, it would have been. Sure would have been. He said, I have interviewed so many people that tell me, you know, this was the biggest influence in my life. You know, record, this was so influential. And then it'll be between the times they're 14 and 17, because you're so, you know, you're old enough that you're able to analyze it in different ways, but you're young enough that, you know, in the time I was learning how to play and stuff, the mystique is still huge. You know, you've not, you know, been running 100,000 miles a year in a bus, you know, like I did later, or flying all over the world, or, you know, everything that goes along with being a working professional musician. But back to Bill. So when you played with Bill, the song I can talk about that I think is the easiest way to talk about, and only the Bluegrass Boys have it. Other people play it, and they play it great, and they sing it great, but it just doesn't have the same feel. There is a stateliness to the rhythm and the feel of, and we would open up the second show every night with I'm On My Way Back to the Old Home. And the way we would play it, it's just an entirely different animal than everybody else that plays it. And it's just, so that's what you learned
from the source musician guys that you couldn't get it from the records. You could memorize the records, you could get the feel off the records and everything else, but you didn't know how the rhythm felt until you were with the guy. And you were with the guy, and what I mean is, he would not, you were joining the band had already been together for a long time, and he had the band playing rhythm like he wanted them to play it. Same with Earl, you know, he would have already had, Randy Scruggs knew how to play guitar with his dad, mm-hmm. You know, Gary Scruggs knew how to play bass with his dad, because if it hadn't have been what Earl needed, he would have said, I need you to do this, you know, because they did know, and, you know, they had a sound that they were going to get. So that was that's what you learn from being around the source guys. And I think another thing that you learned, that I learned, was you also learned that not every note that was on every record was exactly like they would have done it. Because, you know, when you're a kid learning, it's like every note is like, you know, Moses with the,
yeah.
carved in the stone.
And you forever think it's supposed to sound like that.
Yes, but then when you got around them, you would find out, you know, different things about, you know, Bill might talk about a certain break on a record that somebody took, and he said, oh, I never did like that right there. I never did like that, and I'd really appreciate you leaving that out. You know, but I had this huge advantage that I'd been around him, and I knew what he didn't like. And nobody else that would have taken that job at the time I did would have known everything that he didn't like. They would have assumed that to play the fiddle job, you should have played it this way. But for one thing, I did know, because Kenny Baker had left in 84, and then I came in early 85, so there were about a 6 or 7 month gap in there. But I didn't know from being around Bill Monroe that the way to play fiddle with Bill Monroe, since Kenny had just left and Kenny had been there, you know, 16 and a half years, that stretch, and then three other stretches, I knew not to come into that job playing fiddle like Kenny Baker, even though Kenny Baker was, you know, what made me want to play a fiddle, you know, as a profession, you know, I could play one, but I never, you know, was just crazy about playing one until I heard Kenny play with Bill. And then there again, it was the sound that made me want to play a fiddle. But I knew if I'd have come in playing like Kenny Baker, that would not have been good, because, you know, the wound was still fresh.
That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about the best way. So I played anything but that, you know, even though I knew, gosh, did I? You know, I'd studied. I mean, you can't play a fiddle any better than the way Kenny played Mule Skinner Blues with Monroe, you know. And if I play Mule Skinner Blues with somebody today, I'm going to play just like that. But I knew, so I came up, I kind of based mine on the 1950 record with Vassar, and then I, you know, put my own stuff. Because, you know, when you're playing with Bill Monroe, really, Mule Skinner's kind of like, okay, what you going to do on the fiddle? Because you got three, it's a fiddle song.
Yeah.
You know, three long breaks, you know, and you're the intro, then you're the first break, and you're the third break, and then the song's over, and then you got all the fills, you know, which was pretty much the Bill Monroe gig, which is why, I mean, that changed my life, you know, playing with Bill Monroe on fiddle. From the minute I started with Bill Monroe, you know, I had started my recording career in Cincinnati, and then when I moved here, was recording, you know, with different people doing things, but from the minute I started playing with Bill Monroe, it was literally overnight, because Emory Gordy Jr. was Bill's producer, and he had never produced Bill. In fact, he'd retired. He'd moved back to Georgia, Dallas, Georgia, where he's from. And so both of us were going to record with Bill for the first time together. And so Emory started using me on everything. And then Tony Brown started using me on everything. And then Jimmy Bowen started using me on everything. And so I had everybody on MCA. I was playing on their stuff. And then, so the way that would work, you know,
to hear is that, so then every session you would meet all the other musicians, they would recommend you. The engineers would recommend you. A bunch of, you know, how it grows was that way. So, and it all became, and I knew that. That's why I always wanted to play the fiddle with Bill Monroe. I really never thought I'd get the chance because I really didn't think Kenny was ever going to retire, you know. And I know Kenny would always say, you know, because we were great friends. He lived about 15 minutes from me here and out in Cottontown, and that's where he lived. And he would say all the time, well, I guess I'll retire him, you know, meaning he was going to play with Bill until Bill retired. But, you know, as they got on, you know, they'd been in the same deal for so long that they both just wanted a break. pretty much all you could say, you know, 16 years together and in a row. But they rewrote Fiddle. But I think I should probably tell you the story about Kenny Baker and me, because I like to do this just to give credit to Kenny Baker. So I'm a little kid, and my dad says, hey, Ralph Stanley's going to be at Bean Blossom this Sunday. And I said, well, that's great. Because, boy, I was some kind of hooked on Little Maggie by then. I mean, I was playing banjo all the time. Banjo, banjo, banjo. And so I really went to see Ralph. I mean, I'd seen Monroe, you know, probably by that time, who knows, 60 times or something. And so we went to see Ralph. And Ralph had, you know, Roy Lee and Jack Cook and boy, Curly Ray. Man, what a great band. And I don't think Ricky and Keith were at that show. I don't think. Maybe they were. They might have been in the band. No. Yeah, they would have been, too, because I'm thinking how old I was at that time. And so we saw Ralph, and boy, that was, you know, afternoon show. So it was like the Goins brothers first, then Ralph, then Bill. And it's a very interesting chain of events right here that only happened one time ever that I ever either saw or experienced, and I did several hundred shows with Bill. Never saw him ever do this ever again, but I know now why he did what he did. And if he hadn't have done that, man, my life would probably been different. I'd have been a musician. It just would have taken a different turn. So Ralph Stanley goes, and he kills it, just kills it. And he encores about three times in Bill's place, in Bill's barn, in front of Bill's crowd. And they don't want Ralph to quit. So Ralph finally just has to say, folks, you know, they're saying, no, do more and more. And knowing how Bill was, competitive, you know, oh, boy, that's wearing on him. And so Ralph leaves the stage. And so my dad says, you know, hey, you want to stay and see Bill? And I said, oh, you know, I've seen you so many times, and I got school tomorrow, you know, get up early and all that. So I said, let's just go ahead and go. Okay. So we're in the old barn, and we get up, just me and my dad, and we're walking towards the exit of the old barn. And there was an old concession stand there on the left and some old theater seats on the right that I'm sure – Birch got, maybe they just had them dumped there or something. And so I'm within 25 feet of the back door of it's the door you come into the old barn. And leaving the barn, if it had been 30 more seconds, this would have never happened. But as we get within 25 feet of that door, Monroe comes out on stage with the Bluegrass Boys and opens with Uncle Penn. Never saw him do it ever again. Never knew of him ever doing it ever again. But he's going to come with his number one.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. He's coming after Ralph getting three encores on his home turf. And he comes right out and boom, ba doodle down. And it's Baker playing Uncle Penn. And I mean, the sound of his fiddle was so huge and so dark and big and fat. I'd never heard anything because I was used to fiddles. You know, I could play a little and I thought nothing about being able to play ragtime Annie and all that. Yeah, I could just do it. But I didn't like the tone of what I heard. I heard guys playing, you know, that bright, you know, kind of thin sound.
Yeah.
Didn't dig it. But I heard this, man, that fiddle sound big as a truck. And I mean, it literally stopped me in my tracks. And I just turned around and froze and looked at the stage. And I said, what is that? And, of course, my dad, being my dad, said, what do you mean, what's that? He said, heck, that's Uncle Penn. He said, you've heard that song your whole life. I said, I ain't never heard it like that. And he said, well, you want to go back in and sit down? And I said, yeah. And so, because everybody in the place is over at Ralph's and Curly Ray's record table, there's like seats right down front. So we go all the way back in. I mean, we hadn't left, but I mean, we go all the way down front. I sit on about the third row in front of Kenny and just stare up at him for the entire time. Never took my eyes off of, and that sound. And they did Mule Skinner. I can remember that. And man, I was never the same. And I, you know, I said, man, I gotta play fiddle. I want to make that sound right there. And had not been for Kenny Baker, I'm not sure that I would ever have done that. And had not been for that Sunday, and just happened to, like I said, 30 more seconds, I'd have been outside the barn. You know, who knows? I might have been, you know, a steel guitar player, or you know, playing electric guitar with Linda Ronstadt or something. I don't know. But because I was determined I was going to be a professional musician. I never questioned about that, but never had thought about playing the fiddle. And then from that minute on, man, I didn't think of anything else till I was probably about 24 or 5. I would practice 6 hours a day every day, and then you know, everything that I did between then and 1980 was because I saw Kenny Baker play with Bill Monroe.
You know, and Glenn, it's one of those. It's an opportunity, but you took advantage of it. It's an opportunity. It's like serendipity as you're about to walk out, but then you took advantage of it, and you used it, and it changed your life.
That's the whole thing.
Isn't that something?
Yes. And mm-hmm. My whole, you know, creed after that thing was, boy, I know one thing. I'm going to – and my, kind of part of my thing was, I always thought I'm going to treat being a musician just like I would treat being a doctor or an attorney or something. I'm going to study it, and, you know, it's going to be like a profession to me. You know, I'm going to analyze it. I'm going to get all these records. So I did. Boy, I got those records. And I was really lucky. We had some ex-Bluegrass boys lived right around there because they'd moved up there. But Monroe had like a farm team in the 50s. You know, he'd run across a good musician in North Carolina. He'd hire him and have him come be in the house band at the Brown County Jamboree. And then when he needed him on the Opry and the Bluegrass Boys, he just moved them into there. So we had a, you know, guy named Vernon McQueen was in Connersville, been a lead singer. And then Roger Smith was a really great musician. Banjo and fiddle lived right in our hometown. And so he knew, you know, kind of the basics of how the thing went, you know, how you know, Uncle Penn went and all that. But the thing I did, I would go back and, man, study that record. And, boy, you know, studying Red Taylor playing Uncle Penn, there's your, you know, between that and Benny Martin, that's the right hand. You know, that was the right hand. You know, that was the right hand. And then, you know, everything else. And then I, you know, studied a lot of violinists, too. Yasha Heifetz, and particularly him, and Rishi, and the guys, to see how they went about it, and studied, you know, classical music. But I never, like, took violin lessons. I just have a huge collection of classical music, and then and I would analyze how they were doing what they were doing, you know, with because I figured, for one thing, they had been studying it for 400 years. So I figured there was a lot of techniques, which, again, goes back to kind of our other theme about with Earl. I was able to ask Earl, how did you play the, you know, C7th lick on Shuckin' the Corn? Well, I did it like this. Whereas I couldn't ask Beethoven now, you know, how'd you happen to write that bridge? You know, how come you just have one chorus? You know, how come you didn't have the chorus for a beat or something?
Well,
but I would ask, you know, I would ask Bill all the time. You know, I took a tape recorder. It's pretty cool. Because one thing I was really bound and determined to do with Bill, all of the, you know, like the real canon of bluegrass, of Fiddletons, you know, Billy in the Lowground, Arkansas Traveler, Katie Hill, Patty on the Turnpike, Ojo Clark, Fire on the Mountain, you know, maybe 10 of them, you know, that are the real Turkey in the Straw, you know, the 10 most played. Cotton Eye Joe played like they used to play it, you know, with Reno and Smiley or Monroe or Benny Martin. But so I was bound and determined to play all those tunes like Monroe felt they went. So I took a tape recorder on the bus several trips and would tape him sitting there playing those. Oh, and he loved that, you know. And I wasn't doing it to, you know, to impress him or anything. I just really wanted to know because I wanted it to be where if somebody requested Gray Eagle, I was going to play Gray Eagle like Bill Monroe wanted it to play because I was in the Bluegrass Boys. And I felt an obligation to play, and I did with every band. I felt an obligation with Jim and Jesse. When I played Sweet Little Miss Blue Eyes, I was going to play it like Jimmy Buchanan had played it on the record because I felt like his part was as big a part of the success of that record as the words to the song or Jim's tenor or Jesse's lead. So everybody that I worked with, they would know. And the other thing was, well, then they had 100% confidence that, by golly, you studied my record. Even when I started touring with Reba McEntire, and she wasn't going to do 5% of any of those songs, you know, because she was recording every year. And but I got every record she'd put out up to that point, and I learned all the songs. Because one thing about it, and it was the same way about learning to play the fiddle, I was never, ever going to be in a position of saying, I don't know that one. I wasn't going to be that guy. With Monroe, it was funny because he would play this game on stage. You know, and I was pretty young. I was in my 20s, you know, so, you know, young guy in a bluegrass boy hat. So he would play this game with the crowd on the second show. It was really like stump the band. But he would say, you know, and he loved getting requests. So he'd say, are there any requests? Of course, you know, most of them would be Molly and Tim Brooks and that stuff, you know. But lots of times it would be those obscure instrumentals, and he'd turn around to me and go, do you know that one? And I'd say, yes, sir. And he'd say, oh, let's go with it, boy. And I'd cut down on it, you know, and because I knew them all. And I already knew them all because that's how I learned to play. But I just always felt like, you know, if you're gonna work for somebody like that, man, you know, you should have enough respect for them and the job and their fans to know all their material. I've always felt that.
Glenn, we have covered, and I'll say this again, we've covered just a little bit of what you've done in the studio and what you've done.
Oh, yeah.
But we haven't even gotten to the Smashing Pumpkins yet.
Oh, that's right.
We'll save that for another time.
We'll
save Billy Corgan. Yeah, and Mark Knopfler. Yeah. We'll save those for another time. Yeah, I want you to, you had one song from Longview. That you wanted to intro, I think it's Lost Cave, and do that, and then I'll let you leave, and we'll come back another time and catch up. When the album comes out, full, we'll talk again.
Oh, yeah. That sounds great. Right. Yeah, so Lost Cave with Longview, and boy, Longview's one of the most fun things I ever did. There were six guys, and it's kind of an interesting way that we were put together, because what happened was Rounder Records was celebrating an anniversary of their record label. And so each of the three partners, you know, picked something they wanted to do. And it might not even be a musical project, just but something they wanted to do. So what Ken Irwin wanted to do was he wanted to, and it's pretty interesting because what had happened, Dudley Connell and me and Joe Mullins, and some other, Larry Stevenson was involved in it. In fact, I rode up on Larry's bus. We did a thing at Columbus, Ohio, for Daryl Adkins. And I'm trying to think who else. But all I remember, you know, with the Longview thing was, so that was Dudley and me and Joe. And that was the first time that we'd all known each other. I'd known Joe his whole life. I actually took Paul's place in the Boys of Indiana when I was 21. I think I was 21. So I've known Joe since Joe was about 11. And so, like I said, when Paul quit, I was the first person that joined who wasn't one of the original five. It was still Noah Grace.
you know, Noah Kreis and then Aubrey Holt and Jerry Holt and Harley Gabbard and Paul Quitt, and I went to work with them. And so Joe I'd known all that time, and then I'd known Dudley since the late 70s when I was with Sparks. And we had played at the Bluegrass Unlimited Festival together, Johnson Mountain Boys and Larry Sparks. And so I met him, and that's the day I met Eddie Stubbs and Dudley and everybody. And so I'd known Dudley all that time. Huge, just loved everything about the way Dudley played, sang, and boy, he's 100% in every single time he does something, sing one. If he sings a song in your living room, he's just as in as he would be at Merle Fest. You know, it's the same thing every time he does something. I love that. As I've always felt the same way, you know, about playing and singing. So the three of us played together. And then at the same time, like the next weekend or something, there was a festival up, you know, east somewhere. And Dudley and James King and Don Rigsby sang Angels Are Singing Tonight, the Stanley Brothers song, together. And, you know, with the Dudley singing tenor and Don singing high baritone. And Ken heard that. So really what happened was the two, though, you know, Dudley was the common denominator in both, and that ended up being, so Ken was like, well, I want to put my favorite bluegrass musicians all in one band and have them make an album. And we're going to go to this place in Massachusetts called Longview Farms, and that's what I want to do for my part of celebrating Rounders, you know, whatever anniversary it would have been. It was in 1995. That's when it was. Very last weekend of November, when it, you know, became December of 95. So it was Dudley Connell, me, James King, Joe Mullins, Don Rigsby, and Marshall Wilburn was the bass player, because Dudley and him had worked together with the Johnson Mountain Boys later. And so the six of us all flew to Boston and then went out to Longview Farms and made that first album called Longview. That's what we called it. We didn't have a band name or anything. I mean, it's just, you know, Ken's six favorites all in one place doing, you know, traditional bluegrass songs, really traditional bluegrass. That was our whole concept was, you know, we're going to do all these great songs that are, you know, not, you know, Blue Ridge Cabin Home and all these songs that we love but have been done a lot. So everybody brought in songs, and we went through them, and then we'd record them. So the whole first album is that. And so we did two albums for Rounder, both at Longview Farms, and then the song we're getting ready to play here is a tune that I wrote called The Lost Cave. And I wrote this song. It's a fiddle song. And the whole idea, as I was writing it, I came up with the first part of the melody, and I thought, oh, that's so cool. And then I started thinking, because I'll do this with an instrumental, too, like we were talking about how to write songs a while ago. So then in my mind, I thought, okay, what is this song about? What is this fiddle song about? So in my mind, what this song is about is, it's because it's a minor key song. And as I'm thinking about it, what would a fiddle player do? And I thought, man, here's what this is. So this instrumental, The Lost Cave, is actually about this guy is like a miner for money, a coal miner for money. That's what he has to do. But he, in his heart and soul, he's a fiddle player. So he takes the fiddle with him back into the mines so that, because, you know, they eat lunch and stuff. They don't come all the way back out. They stay back in. And I thought, and I'd actually done a television show where I had to do Mule Skitter Blues in a coal mine in West Virginia for the Nashville Network. And that is a whole nother story we'll talk about next time.
Next time.
So I did know it was possible to play a fiddle back in a coal mine. And so that was my idea was, okay, this guy has taken this fiddle back in here, and now they've had a cave in, and he's not going to make it. And he knows they're not going to make it. And these other guys are all sitting around with him, and it's so lonesome and blue back in there. And he picks out his fiddle, and he starts playing this tune, The Lost Cave.
Okay. Well, we will play that one. I'll say goodbye to you, and you have to promise me that when the new album comes out in total, that you and I will get together and we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about 99% of your career, which we didn't even touch on.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Oh, Steve, I have enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you so much, Glenn.
Yes, sir. This has just been a really enjoyable time, and I promise you, when the album comes out, we will have another wonderful visit.
We will. I promise you. And maybe when we can all move around again, I may catch you somewhere down the road in person.
Oh, absolutely. I really look forward to that, because I'm actually going to start doing that again. It's getting out, because before I realized that, it had been like probably 15 years since I'd really gotten out and played much, because you just have your whole career here where you're doing, sessions every week, you're writing songs every week, you're producing a record every week. And before I knew it, it'd been like, golly, it's been almost 15 years. I probably did three or four things out, a couple of Bluegrass Boy reunion things at Bill's home place on his birthday, and then a couple things for Bill Monroe Mandolin Camp that Mike Compton does. That's just so well done, and I did a couple things for them like that, and I was probably the better. I can't think of much else, but I've just of course I keep up with like I talked to Joe Mullins, like last week, and, I talked to Doug Hutchins actually Monday, and then I run into people all the time, of course, I see all the ones, all the guys that I've known all this time here, like I see Del often and Ricky often and people I've known my whole life, but I really want to get out and see so many of my friends that I've not seen in a long time, but been just a big part of my life, that I've had known me since I was out playing, and man, I really look forward to you and I getting to see each other in person and talk about all this great stuff again. There's just nothing I'd enjoy more.
Well, we'll do it, I promise. And then the audience is going to hear Lost Cave from the Longview album, Lessons in Stone. I think that's it.
Yes.
All right, cool.
Exactly right.
Glenn, thanks so much. I've absolutely enjoyed it. Glenn Duncan, thanks for coming to Unreal Bluegrass. We'll have another one down the road.
Thank you, Steve. I sure do look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, I'll see you, bud.
Yes, sir.
Bye.